From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This year's Pulitzer Prize for Poetry was awarded to Natasha Trethewey for her book Native Guard. On today's Fresh Air, Trethewey reads poems from the book and talks about her life. Many of the poems are autobiographical. Trethewey is biracial and grew up in Mississippi and Georgia. Her parents married when interracial marriage was illegal in Mississippi. They divorced when Trethewey was a child. Her mother remarried and was murdered by her second husband in 1985. Also, critic-at-large John Powers reviews a DVD that collects two masterpieces by the French filmmaker Chris Marker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Natasha Trethewey, won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry this year for her book, Native Guard. Many of the poems are personal, relating to growing up biracial in Mississippi and Georgia. Her white father, an African-American mother, married when interracial marriage was still illegal in Mississippi. Trethewey's parents divorced when she was a child. Her mother remarried and was murdered by her second husband in 1985, about a year after they divorced. Trethewey writes about that, too, in her collection of poems. One section of the book is devoted to the Native Guards, regiments of black soldiers who had been slaves before fighting on the Union side in the Civil War. Natasha Trethewey is an associate professor of creative writing at Emory University in Atlanta. I asked her why she's publishing poems about her mother's murder now, over 20 years after it happened. She told me it took a long time before she could write poems about the murder that were any good.
For many years, I would try occasionally to write a poem about it, and none of the poems that I wrote over a 20-year period since her death were successful to me. They weren't able to express the tremendous grief artfully in a way that I thought that a poem should. And so I didn't start writing ones that make it into this book until I moved back to Atlanta about 6 years ago. And I think returning to the physical landscape of my past and of that great tragedy is what finally made me start writing the poems that I have here now in this book.
How was your mother killed?
My stepfather came to her apartment on the morning of June 5th, 1985, and forced himself into the apartment. He found my brother outside waiting at the school bus and demanded his key and opened the door and found my mother there, and she struggled a bit to get away and ran out into the parking lot where he caught up to her and shot her twice at close range in the face and neck.
I want you to read a poem called What is Evidence? And please introduce it to us before you read it.
What is Evidence is a poem that tries to get at what remains, both in terms of the physical and the memory of something. And I started thinking about writing this poem when I had visited my mother's grave again and felt overwhelmed by how there seemed to be nothing left of her, or nothing left to remind me of her. What is evidence? Not the fleeting bruises she'd cover with makeup, a dark patch as if imprint of a scope she'd pressed her eye too close to, looking for a way out, nor the quiver in the voice she'd steady, leaning into a pot of bones on the stove. Not the teeth she wore in place of her own, or the official document, its seal and smeared signature fading already, the edges wearing. Not the tiny marker with its dates, her name abstract as history. Only the landscape of her body, splintered clavicle, pierced temporal, her thin bones settling a bit each day, the way all things do.
That's a great poem. You know, you titled it What is Evidence? And when you introduced it, you talked about evidence of her life that remains. But it also seems to me that it's about evidence that could be used in her murder trial or
yes,
in previous trials if she brought him to trial about abuse.
That's right. Those things that are in the first lines are the kind of things that were recorded by emergency workers or the lawyers that she talked to in order to secure her divorce, and also things that came up in the first trial a year before when he tried to kill her the first time.
How did he try to kill her the first time?
The first time he tried to kill her was February 14th, 1984. I was a senior in high school, and I was back in my bedroom getting ready for school, and my brother was sitting at the kitchen table, and he saw my stepfather approach my mother in the parking lot, and she began screaming, and I couldn't hear her, and he came back into my room and said, "I just saw Mama and Daddy get in the car together and drive away." And I said, "Go back and finish your breakfast." I knew that she wouldn't just get in the car and drive away. And he had made her do this in order to wait until we left for school so that he could bring her back to the apartment. And we did go to school. I called my grandmother. I called the Battered Women's Shelter to put people on alert to look for her. And in the meantime, he made her drive back to the apartment, and he began taunting her with a syringe full of battery acid.
Oh, God.
So he was stabbing it in her arm, the needle into her arm, and that is how he had intended to kill her the first time.
How did she defend herself?
Well, she tried to talk to him a lot to buy some time, and she had, I think, that she had actually called for a repairman to come and fix our dishwasher, though I'm not sure. It might have just been some great idea that she had. But at some point, the police knocked on the door, and she had been stalling him. And the police knocked, and she told him that it was the dishwasher repairman and for the apartment complex. And, of course, they would come in if we weren't at home. And so he let her open the door so that she could get rid of him, and it was the police instead.
Right. Your mother had been a social worker, and I imagine as a social worker she might have helped battered women in the past, and if so, did that help her figure out how to defend herself and how to extricate herself from the relationship?
Well, I think that because of my mother's master's in social work, as well as her position in Georgia State and DeKalb County government, she had all of the information and resources at her fingertips. She was the kind of person who would know exactly what to do and all the procedures to follow. And what is always struck me as particularly tragic is that even someone like her, who was very well educated and connected to the social work systems here in Georgia, still couldn't escape.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Natasha Trethewey. She won the Pulitzer Prize in Poetry this year, and we're talking about poems in her latest collection, Native Guard. There's another poem I'd like you to read about your mother, and this is called Graveyard Blues. Would you introduce it for us before you read it?
This poem, Graveyard Blues, is about the day we buried my mother, June 11th, 1985. Graveyard Blues. It rained the whole time we were laying her down, rained from church to grave. When we put her down, the suck of mud at our feet was a hollow sound. When the preacher called out, I held up my hand. When he called for a witness, I raised my hand. Death stops the body's work, the soul's a journeyman. The sun came out when I turned to walk away, glared down on me as I turned and walked away, my back to my mother, leaving her where she lay. The road going home was pocked with holes, that home-going road's always full of holes. Though we slow down, time's wheel still rolls. I wander now among names of the dead, my mother's name, stone pillow for my head.
What kind of hole did it leave in your life when your mother died, when she was murdered?
Oh, I think it was the biggest hole imaginable. Not long after she died, I had a dream about her. And in the dream, we were together, and I knew she was dead. And we were walking around a kind of track or something. My stepfather was approaching us from the opposite direction. And as he got closer, I looked at him and I smiled at him, knowing fully what he had done. And I spoke kindly to him. And when he passed us, my mother turned to look at me, and she had a hole the size of a quarter in the center of her forehead, and light was streaming through it. And she said to me, "Do you know what it's like to have a wound that never heals?" And I didn't answer. And we walked around again, and as we made the turn again to come back to the same spot, he was there again, coming toward us, this time holding a gun and pointing it at her. At that moment, I threw myself in front of her in the dream, and I screamed no, and that's when I woke up. But what had stayed with me was that hole, that wound that never heals.
My guest is Natasha Trethewey. She won this year's Pulitzer Prize for Poetry for her book Native Guard. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Natasha Trethewey. She won this year's Pulitzer Prize for Poetry for her book Native Guard. Several poems in the book are about her mother. Her mother was abused by her second husband. He murdered her in 1985, a year after they divorced. How aware were you when they were married, your stepfather and your mother, of the way that he abused her? Did she tell you about it? Did you see evidence of it?
The first time that I was aware of it, I was in the fifth grade, and it happened in the late evening, perhaps 11 o'clock or so, but it was past my bedtime. And my brother had a room that was right next to their bedroom. My bedroom was down the hall, and so I think that's why I didn't know sooner what was going on. And sometimes my brother, if he was afraid to sleep by himself, he was a toddler then, I would sleep in one of the bunk beds in his room. And on that particular night, I woke up to hear the sound coming from their bedroom of him hitting her and her pleading for him not to.
And how old were you in fifth grade?
I was in fifth grade. And the next morning, I went to school, and I was very close to my fifth grade teacher. And I asked her to come outside the classroom so I could talk to her. And we went down to the girls' bathroom, and I told her what happened. And she said, "Well, sometimes adults are upset with each other." And I was crestfallen because I knew that that wasn't the right response. It was just a response that said, "This is how it is, and there's nothing that really can be done." And so that night, I went home, and I went to my mother's room. She was sitting on the bed folding clothes, and I got up my courage, and I said to her in a kind of abstract terms, "Do you know how when you have someone you love and you know they're hurting?" And she looked at me, and she nodded her head, and she had this very large bruise and a bump over her eyebrow. And later on that night, I heard her telling my stepfather, "Tasha knows," as if he might stop if he knew that I knew.
Did he ever threaten you?
Not physically. He would often devise devious punishments for me when I was a child that mainly involved telling me that I was retarded, or that I was like one of the patients at the mental institution where my mother was an administrator at the time, and that I should be committed. And so he'd make me pack my suitcase. And this is, you know, probably when I was in the fourth grade or something. He'd make me pack a suitcase, and then we'd drive around Atlanta for about an hour with me thinking that I was being taken there.
That's tormenting a child.
Yeah, I think it definitely was. it probably seems strange that I would laugh at it now, but at some point I realized that it was a bluff, and that gave me a kind of power, I think.
Did you ever ask yourself how your mother fell in love with him and stayed for him so long, considering how he abused her and tormented you?
Well, she didn't know that he tormented me. I never told her that. I had some idea that it was my responsibility to suffer in silence, go along with my mother's life, assuming that she was the parent and she knew best. And I also think that for a lot of battered women, you don't know at first that he's that kind of guy. I think it takes a while to figure that out. And depending on the man, it might take a little bit longer. At first, it probably came out as some bit of jealousy that was cute or flattering. And I don't think he actually began to hit her until about 4 years or so into their marriage. Mm. And by then, they had my brother, they'd bought a house. There was a kind of trap. And so she started with what she thought, I think, were the best options, and that was therapy and marriage counseling. And so I know that they did that for years.
You know, we've been talking about how your stepfather, who was your mother's second husband, murdered her after their divorce. Her first husband, your father, is white, and your mother was black. They divorced when you were young, and then you lived with your mother. Before we talk about what it was like to grow up mixed race, I'd like you to read a poem called Miscegenation. And this, again, is Natasha Trethewey from her latest collection of poems called Native Guard.
Miscegenation. In 1965, my parents broke two laws of Mississippi. They went to Ohio to marry, returned to Mississippi. They crossed the river into Cincinnati, a city whose name begins with a sound like sin, the sound of wrong, miss in Mississippi. A year later, they moved to Canada, followed a route the same as slaves, the train slicing the white glaze of winter, leaving Mississippi. Faulkner's Joe Christmas was born in winter, like Jesus, given his name for the day he was left at the orphanage, his race unknown in Mississippi. My father was reading War and Peace when he gave me my name. I was born near Easter, 1966, in Mississippi. When I turned 33, my father said, "It's your Jesus year. You're the same age he was when he died." It was spring, the hills green in Mississippi. I know more than Joe Christmas did. Natasha is a Russian name, though I'm not. It means Christmas child. Even in Mississippi.
You know, in that poem, Miscegenation, you mentioned that when your parents got married, they broke two laws. One was the law of miscegenation. Black people and white people were not allowed to marry. And that law was still on the books in Mississippi, which is why they got married out of state. What was the second law of Mississippi that they broke?
Going out of state to get married and returning to Mississippi.
Catch 22.
Right. They get you either way.
When you were growing up, did you get different reactions when you were out with your white father as opposed to when you were out with your black mother?
I did. At an early age, I could detect subtle differences in how we were treated if I was with my father or with my mother and together, what it meant when we were out together. And that's the way that I learned a little bit about how it was possible for me to pass for white when I was with my father and be treated better than if I was downtown with my mother in a store.
Was there ever a part of your life in which you wanted to pass for white or even tried to?
Oh, yes. As an adolescent, I think that it's hard enough being an adolescent and wanting so much to fit in with your peers, your schoolmates, and to erase any sign of difference to be part of the group. And being biracial, but also being black in a predominantly white school, marked me as different. And so upon arriving at a new school, it was quite possible for me to pass by not saying anything at all. Often people would mistake me for white when I was younger, and if I didn't correct them, there would be a period of time that they just thought I was.
Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Natasha Trethewey will be back in the second half of our show. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the classics edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, in stores and online at bn.com. And from TIAA Cref, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement, online at TIAACREF.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, John Powers reviews two films he considers masterpieces by French filmmaker Chris Marker, who Powers says we might consider the forefather of today's bloggers. And we continue our conversation with Natasha Trethewey, winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Natasha Trethewey. She won this year's Pulitzer Prize for Poetry for her book Native Guard. Many of the poems are autobiographical. Some of them are about growing up biracial in Mississippi and Georgia. Her white father, an African-American mother, married when interracial marriage was still illegal in Mississippi. Were there consequences your parents faced living in Mississippi and being an interracial couple, and were there consequences that you faced as a child of mixed race?
Well, I think that the difficulties really weighed on my parents and their marriage. But I think that beyond the kind of problems that people who are in that kind of relationship, any kind of marriage would have, my parents also had these external forces that were quite scary. For example, when I was a baby, the Klan burned a cross in the driveway of my grandmother's house where we were all living briefly. And I think that there was always that threat somewhere looming behind us.
How scary was that for you when you saw a cross burning on your lawn? And did you even understand, were you old enough to understand yet what the Klan was and what the intention was of burning the cross?
No, I really was too young to understand any of that. And my parents, of course, were keeping me from seeing what was going on. And so a lot of it has returned to me as stories that they told in recollecting what happened. And even now, we wonder what the intention of the cross burning was, because my grandmother lived across the street in Gulfport, Mississippi, from the Mount Olive Baptist Church, which in the late 60s was doing voter registration drives for black voters. And so my grandmother had a driveway. The church did not have a driveway. And so on Sunday, she let the church park its bus in her driveway. And so it's quite possible that people thought that the driveway belonged to the church and that the cross was burned as a threat to the people who were doing voter registration. It might have also been a threat to this interracial couple who was living inside the house, or it might have been a way to threaten both.
How old were you when your parents divorced?
I was 6.
And then you went to live with your mother.
That's right. My mother and my father divorced during the time that my father was getting his PhD at Tulane. And we had been commuting back and forth from Gulfport to New Orleans, which was about an hour's drive. We had an apartment in Gulfport, and my father had a roommate in New Orleans that he would go and stay with during the week for class. And sometimes we'd go and visit him on the weekends, or he'd come to Gulfport. And so it seemed like a very gentle transition, strangely, for me when they actually divorced and my mother and I moved to Atlanta for my mother to start graduate school.
Did it change your racial identity when there was no longer like a white father in your home?
Well, I can't say that it changed my racial identity, because though I was a biracial child and my parents talked to me about what they thought that meant, I also understood that I was a black child,
mm-hmm.
and that didn't change.
Now, your father is a poet and a professor of literature at Hollins University in Virginia, which is where you got your master's degree, and I believe he was teaching there at the time.
That's right.
At the risk of sounding obvious, he must be awfully proud you won the Pulitzer Prize this year.
Indeed he is. He is a proud papa right now.
Were there poems you remember him reading to you as a kid?
Oh, yes. I from the time that I understood that he was a poet, which was probably about the time that I was in the 7th grade. That's when I really got it and knew what it meant. His first book had come out, and I had read all those poems myself, but he also read them to me, talked about them, because a lot of them were, well, they're very autobiographical about his own family and growing up in Canada. And so it was great to hear those poems, because they were the first poems that I really felt that I could enter into, not as simply a kind of a distant reader, the way you might read a poem in class at school, but as an intimate reader who knew the stories and found my own place in the language.
My guest is Natasha Trethewey. She won this year's Pulitzer Prize for poetry for her book Native Guard. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. If you're just joining us, my guest is Natasha Trethewey. She won a Pulitzer Prize for poetry this year. Her new collection is called Native Guard. There's three main subjects that you write about in Native Guard. There's the murder of your mother, who was murdered by your stepfather, from whom she was divorced. There's poems about growing up biracial and about the marriage between, you know, your mother's first marriage to your father, who was white. Then the middle section of the book is a series of 10 poems. I believe they're sonnets about the Native Guard. And I'm going to ask you to read a section of that. But before I do, tell us the story of the Louisiana Native Guard.
Well, the Louisiana Native Guards were the first officially sanctioned regiment of African-American soldiers for the Union Army in the Civil War, and they were mustered into service in September, October, and November of 1862. And the regiment, the 2nd Regiment, was stationed just off the coast of my hometown, Gulfport, Mississippi, on Ship Island, where there was a fort called Fort Massachusetts, and they were there to guard Confederate prisoners.
And were these mostly ex-slaves?
Well, the 2nd Regiment actually was made up primarily of former slaves. The 1st Regiment was made up of a lot of free men of color from Louisiana, many of whom might have been slave owners themselves. In the 2nd Regiment, there was a Major Dumas, who was the son of a white Creole father and a mulatto or octoroon mother. And when his father died, he inherited a plantation and all of its slaves. And though he was someone who did not agree with slavery or want to hold slaves, it was illegal in Louisiana at the time for him to manumit those slaves. But when the Union Army started recruiting black soldiers and mustering these troops, he joined, and he freed his slaves and encouraged the men of age to join as well.
Now, the first sonnet I'm going to ask you to read from this cycle of sonnets about the Native Guard is called April 1863, and it relates to an incident during the Civil War, a battle in Pascagoula. Tell us the story of Pascagoula before you read it.
Pascagoula is another town near Gulfport, and there was a skirmish in April of 1863 between the 2nd Regiment of the Native Guards and some Confederate troops. And toward the end of the battle, the black soldiers, the Native Guards, were retreating back toward the beach so that they could board the ship and go back to the fort on the island. And at that point, it was time for the Union sailors who were on board the ship to fire at the enemy to give them a little bit of protection so that they could get back, they could retreat safely and get back on the ship. Instead of doing that, the sailors fired directly at the Native Guards, their own Union soldiers.
And why did they do that?
Well, some historians who've written about the island have talked about that there had been a little bit of tension on the island between some white troops from the Northeast, Union troops who were there, and the Native Guards, not wanting to interact, take orders from, or whatever, the black troops.
These poems that you've written about the Native Guard, whose voice are you writing them in?
I am writing in the voice of the imagined voice of one of the men who might have been a former slave of Major Dumas and who then would have been freed and enlisted in the 2nd Regiment.
And the 2nd Regiment, is that the regiment that was fired on by white soldiers from the North?
Yes, it is. The 2nd Regiment is the one that was stationed at Ship Island guarding Confederate prisoners and was fired upon.
Would you read April 1863 and then June 1863 for us?
Yes, I'd be happy to. April 1863. When men die, we eat their share of hardtack, trying not to recall their hollow sockets, the worm stitch of their cheeks. Today we buried the last of our dead from Pascagoula and those who died retreating to our ship, white sailors in blue firing upon us as if we were the enemy. I'd thought the fighting over, then watched a man fall beside me, knees first as in prayer, then another, his arms outstretched as if borne upon the cross. Smoke that rose from each gun seemed a soul departing. The colonel said, an unfortunate incident, said, their name shall deck the page of history. June, 1863. Some name shall deck the page of history as it is written on stone. Some will not. Yesterday, word came of colored troops dead on the battlefield at Port Hudson, how General Banks was heard to say, I have no dead there, and left them unclaimed. Last night I dreamt their eyes still open, dim, clouded as the eyes of fish washed ashore, yet fixed, staring back at me. Still more come today, eager to enlist. Their bodies, haggard faces, gaunt limbs, bring news of the mainland. Starved, they suffer like our prisoners. Dying, they plead for what we do not have to give. Death makes equals of us all, a fair master.
What made you so interested in the Native Guard? I mean, your poem, the poems you read are largely about former slaves who ended up serving in the Union Army, and some of them actually were the guards for Confederate prisoners. It's such an interesting story. Why did you find it interesting enough to write a whole series of poems about?
Well, there are several things that interested me about the Native Guards. One of them is that they were actually mustered into service first as a Confederate regiment. And later on, when the Confederates failed to arm them, they were disbanded. And lots of them talked about having felt compelled, not only because they might have been protecting their own property, but also some of them, I think, felt that they didn't have a choice. And so, for example, someone like Major Dumas was happy when given the opportunity to join again, but this time as a Union soldier. And I think that what's fascinating about them having this dual nature is the way that it speaks to our larger American history, but it also speaks to my own personal history. I use on the cover of this book a photograph of a page from the diary of the colonel who was stationed out there with him, with the troops. He had confiscated this diary from the home of a Confederate, and because of a shortage of paper, he cross-wrote in the diary over entries that were already there. And so it becomes this perfect metaphor for the intersections of North and South, but also I think the way that I extend the metaphor in the book by giving the diary instead to this black soldier, it also becomes the intersection of slave and free and black and white, which is, of course, part of the intersections of my own life growing up biracial with a black mother and a white father. And I think it's summed up in a way in these lines that I just read from June 1863. Some names shall deck the page of history as it is written on stone. Some will not. It wasn't until I was, I think, far along into writing the book that's the part about the Civil War and that history, because that I realized that these other poems that I was writing, the poems that are elegies for my mother, were also connected. And what connected my mother to the history of these black soldiers is that neither of them had a marker. Neither of them had a monument, not on my mother's grave, not on Ship Island, that would tell us that they'd been here.
There was no marker on your mother's grave?
No, I never put one on there, and this was one of the things that I realized in writing the book. I hadn't put a marker on my mother's grave all that time because I thought I had to put her name, the name she had when she died, which was still my stepfather's last name. Though she was divorced, she kept his last name, and I didn't want to put that on a permanent marker. And I didn't want to put my father's last name, my last name, there either, because that wouldn't have acknowledged my brother. And it never occurred to me in all those years that I could have put her maiden name, Gwendolyn Ann Turnbow, the woman she was.
So is there still no marker, and do you think you might buy one sometime?
I think I'm going to go down there and put one on there now. A colleague of mine at when I was visiting University of North Carolina is the person who first suggested to me her maiden name, and I felt so ridiculous when he said it, that how in all that time had it not occurred to me that that was the way to do it. But it was because of talking about this book, and so I think in many ways having written these poems has allowed me to figure out something that, you know, had stumped me for, you know, over 20 years.
You won the Pulitzer Prize this year. It's certainly, you know, one of the absolute highest honors an American writer can, you know, an American poet can get. Do you feel like it's changed your life in any way?
Well, I've certainly been busier for the past few months. I don't know how I'll think about this a year from now or whatever, even a few months from now, in terms of it changing my life. But I think that what I'm most delighted with is that I received the honor at this time in my life for a book that tries to honor the memory of my mother. I was 40 the day that they called, that all the reporters started calling to tell me that I'd won. The same age my mother was when she died, and I was also just shy of my 41st birthday. And I knew years ago that I was writing this book, and I wanted it to, in terms of the timing, to appear at the same, at this moment for me, because reaching that age was very symbolic for me. What I couldn't have imagined is that it would have been honored in this way.
Natasha Trethewey, congratulations on your Pulitzer. Thank you so much for speaking to us and to reading some of your poems for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. This has been delightful.
Natasha Trethewey won the Pulitzer Prize this year for her book Native Guard. She's an associate professor of creative writing at Emory University. Coming up, John Powers reviews two films he considers masterpieces that have just come out on DVD. This is Fresh Air. For more than 50 years, the French director Chris Marker has been known for his films which blend travelogue, philosophy, history, and politics. Although he's greatly admired by cinephiles, his work has never really reached a wider public. Criterion has now released a DVD containing perhaps his two most famous works, Sans Soleil and La Jetée, which critic Pauline Kael once said might be the greatest science fiction film ever made. Our critic at large, John Power, says that Marker is one of his intellectual heroes. John thinks Marker's work may be more relevant now than ever.
In Don DeLillo's novel, The Names, there's a renegade director named Frank Volterra, who riffs on the nature of the movies. Film is more than the 20th century art, he says. It's part of the 20th century mind. It's the world seen from inside. Nobody's work embodies that claim better than Chris Marker, the publicity-shy French filmmaker, now in his 86th year, who's the closest thing the movies have ever produced to Diderot or Voltaire. Over the years, Marker fought in the French Resistance, wrote novels, wandered the globe, and even produced a dazzling CD-ROM. This when he was well into his 70s. But above all, he's made films, tackling everything from the mysteries of his Japanese girlfriend to the depressing historical arc of communism. Marker does something that few people have ever done. He turns movies into essays. He uses them as a way of thinking. And you can see this in a new DVD from Criterion that brings together his two masterpieces, La Jetée and Sans Soleil. First released in 1962, La Jetée is Marker's one truly narrative film, a 28-minute science fiction story set in post-apocalyptic Paris. In hopes of saving humanity, scientists want to send somebody back to 60s France. But to do it, they need somebody whose memory is glued to that period. They find him in the nameless hero, who since he was a small boy has been haunted by the image of a woman he saw on the observation deck at Orly Airport. And so he goes back to find her. As a plot, La Jetée may sound conventional, and in fact, it was remade as the Hollywood film 12 Monkeys. But what makes the movie unforgettable is that it's done entirely in still photographs, except for two teasing seconds of motion when a woman blinks her eyes. You might think this would make the story hard to get into, but in fact, it does precisely the opposite. These still photos become the very image of shattered time and fractured memory, so that when we finally see motion, real cinematic movement, the effect is hauntingly transcendent. We see things anew. Something similar happens in Sans Soleil from 1984, in which a woman narrator tells us about letters she's received from a globe-trotting friend, an obvious stand-in for Marker himself, who tells her about what he's seen in his travels. All this is accompanied by footage from Iceland, Africa, San Francisco, and above all, Marker's beloved Tokyo. We see pachinko parlors and roaring volcanoes, revisit the locations of Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, and gaze at beautiful women. Marker is French, after all. And in one lacerating bit of footage, he shows us the killing of a giraffe, one of the most haunting deaths I've ever seen on a screen. I'm afraid this may make the movie sound like a glorified travelogue, which would be a bit like saying that Joyce's Ulysses is about some guy's day in Dublin. In fact, Sans Soleil is a rich, seductive exploration of time, travel, history, death, and politics. It's filled with brilliant perceptions, like the remark that memory is not the opposite of forgetting, but it's lining. Marker has always been a committed man of the left, but never in the pushy Michael Moore sense. He's reflective. Here, over footage from Guinea-Bissau, we get a rumination on the fate of its president, Amilcar Cabral, after revolution freed that country from Portugal.
Rumor has it that every third world leader coined the same phrase the morning after independence. Now the real problems start. Cabral never got a chance to say it. He was assassinated first. But the problems started and went on and are still going on. Rather unexciting problems for revolutionary romanticism. To work, to produce, to distribute, to overcome post-war exhaustion, temptations of power and privilege. Ah, well, after all, history only tastes bitter to those who expected it to be sugar-coated.
It's Marker's genius that he's able to tie everything together, the political and the personal, the excitement of great events, and the beauty of banality, all the things, he says, that quicken the heart. And because all this is rooted in his life and his travels, we might reasonably see him as the forefather of today's bloggers, who put all their thoughts, their photos, and their video footage out there for all the world to see. Characteristically, Marker likes such democratized technology rather than fears it, which is just one of the reasons why he matters more than ever. His work doesn't merely make him the blogger's precursor. It makes him the gold standard, the platonic ideal. You see, Marker knows that it isn't enough to dash down your thoughts or grab footage. By themselves, such things mean very little. The real skill comes in how you weave them together, how you link ideas and images to create something personal that documents and illuminates the way we live now. Every blogger should be sent a copy of Marker's work with a note that says simply, "This, my friend, is how it's done."
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. He reviewed a new DVD with two films by Chris Marker. Fresh Air is now podcasting. If you'd like to download copies of our show, go to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menjivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from hotels.com, with virtual tours, customer reviews, and over 70,000 properties to choose from. Online or at 800-3-HOTELS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, an increasingly popular form of infertility treatment, carrying a fertilized donor egg. We talk with Peggy Orenstein, who wrote about donor eggs in Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Her memoir is about undergoing 6 years of infertility treatments. Join us for the next Fresh Air.